FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Kerry Lutz, and today is March 4th, 2017. So talk a lot about asset protection on the show, about making sure that that your wealth is secure from whatever may come in the future. There's so many threats on the horizon, so many black swans. You don't know which one is going to get you. It was Mark Twain who said, it's not what you don't know that's going to do you in. It's what you think you know that isn't true that's going to get you. And with us is Mark Nessman, and he's an expert in asset protection. But it's not just asset protection in terms of asset protection as how you protect yourself from the law. It's asset protection on a whole nother scale. And Mark, you've been all over the media as well as in the alternative media. Our good friend Jim Poplava, you've been on his Financial Sense Network, Oxford Club, Sovereign Society, and Daily Reckoning, and Simon Black's Sovereign Man. So we're thrilled to have you on our show now. Welcome.
Kerry, thank you. It's good to be here.
Hey, so when you think about asset protection, how do you define it now? I think it's got a broader definition than what it was when I went to law school.
Well, I call it a plan B, and this is nothing new. There's a lot of people who talk about having a plan B, but I suppose my definition of a plan B might be a little bit more expansive than other people. Basically, it begins with making yourself, making your family, making the people that you care about as financially self-sufficient as possible. And by that, I mean, first of all, save enough money, hopefully, and certainly a bank account and a strong bank is a good start. Cash at home, small denomination gold and silver coins at home, food storage, weapons, ammunition, security, and so on is the very beginning of it. Once you've accomplished that, I like the idea, especially if you have a lot of financial assets that are in institutions, getting them out of your name, using things like trusts and LLCs to do that. I really like Delaware LLCs. They're effectively anonymous. But really, any state LLC laws are pretty good, although they may not be as private as Delaware. Then get out of debt, unless the only way to protect a valuable asset like your home from being taken away from you in a lawsuit. And for that, I would certainly recommend equity stripping mortgages, things like growing equity loans, which are essentially friendly loans issued by your LLC, home equity lines of credit, and this sort of thing. Next, and once you've built up enough money to satisfy your immediate needs, I like the idea of getting financial assets and physical assets outside the U.S. And so I'm talking about things like foreign accounts, foreign bank accounts, foreign securities accounts, foreign precious metals accounts. For precious metals, I'm sure a lot of your listeners understand the difference between allocated and unallocated precious metals. We only recommend fully allocated precious metals that are not obligated to anyone else. These are things that you own absolutely 100% with no encumbrances. If you're a wealthier client, we like the idea of things like non-US LLCs, international trusts. We like jurisdictions like Nevis and the Cook Islands for those things. I've always been a big advocate of getting a physical residence, a personal residence outside the U.S. You don't necessarily have to own it. You can rent it. If you own it, that's better. Buy something small, something you wouldn't mind living in. It's okay to rent it out. You have to pay tax on that. But basically, get yourself an avenue outside the U.S. in case we have a SHTF scenario. If you can buy it through an LLC, that's best. You avoid a foreign probate proceeding if you do that. Try to set up legal residence outside the U.S. that actually you have the right to live in another country long term. And then finally, if you have, again, this is expensive, if you have the opportunity, we like the idea of second citizenships and passports. Although a surprising number of people qualify for a second citizenship and passport based on their ancestry, who they're married to, even their religion. If you're, for instance, if you're Jewish, you qualify for an Israeli passport. If you're the grandson of an Irish person or granddaughter of an Irish citizen, you qualify for Irish citizenship, and so on.
Interesting. So I never think of an Israeli passport as being useful in the scheme of if things really go down the tubes, because Israel is not exactly a loved country, but I guess any port in a storm?
Yeah, that's how I would look at it. I mean, an Israeli passport, I mean, you have a situation now where the U.S. government can take away your U.S. passport if you owe tax to the IRS. So whether it's from Israel or it's from Ireland, wherever it is, if you buy one, I mean, we are the only agents in the United States for the Commonwealth of Dominica's citizenship by investment program. So you can actually purchase citizenship through an investment from Dominica and some other countries for a price starting as low as $100,000. So it's not cheap. And again, if you can afford it, this is a great insurance policy.
Interesting. So you think it's really going to come down to this, Mark? You think this country is really going to go into full-blown civil war?
Well, I hope not. I mean, you always hope for the best and prepare for the worst, and that's my philosophy. You know, I like living in the U.S. I have a second residence in Panama. I can go down there anytime I want. I'd rather live here. But if if things get bad enough, I have a way out.
So always have a plan B, like you're talking about.
Exactly. And then just go on living your life. I mean, that's really all you can do. I'm not one of these people that believe in living in a walled compound and in full blown survival mode 24 hours a day. I certainly respect people who do that, but I choose not to. But at the same time, I'm certainly cognizant of the threats that exist.
Yeah. Well, I would be lying to you if I said that I hadn't given them a lot of thought myself and hadn't taken a lot of the actions that you mentioned in your list there. The only thing I haven't done is gotten a dog, which I think personal security in your house is probably the best thing you can do by far. You know, you can have all the alarm systems you like, but the dog knows the second somebody takes a step on your driveway, the dog is barking, letting you know. No alarm is that smart, you know?
You know, that's a great point. I don't have a dog either. And that is I think that would be a terrific security measure. Obviously, you need to train the dog to bark at the appropriate time and not just wag its tail when a visitor comes.
Yeah. Yeah. Not lick him and give him a hug, you know? Yeah, obviously. But it's all things I thought about, and now we're closer to it than ever. And you look at what's going on around the country, the divisiveness, the violence, political violence that's taking place. I always thought it was going to be economic violence. I never believed, Mark, that it was going to be political violence that would set it off. But here we are, people being attacked for espousing political views. It's just shocking to me.
Very sad, but you're right. I mean, I didn't think it would happen this way either. I figured if we went into a real, seriously social unrest type situation, would be due to economic pressure. Although we certainly have plenty of that. I mean, I don't think we've ever left the recession of 2008, 2009. I don't think a lot of those jobs are coming back. They've been replaced by technology. So I think the political violence is fueled by the economic instability and the slow realization of tens of millions of Americans that the jobs they've lost are not coming back, no matter what politician might be promising them to return. I mean, okay. I'm from West Virginia.
Yeah.
And, those coal mining jobs are gone. They're gone for good. They're not coming back. Any increase in coal mining is going to come through technology, not through hiring new miners.
Yeah. And then when you think there's going to be self-driving vehicles, the largest profession, the largest job in America is being a driver. Millions of people, that's all they do is drive. And to think in 10 years that will be gone, just
5 million people, I believe, is the number I've read.
Yeah.
Those jobs will mostly be gone. I mean, I suppose if you want a personal chauffeur, you'll still be able to have one. But that personal chauffeur will probably sit in the front seat of the self-driving car and just be pouring you drinks.
Yeah, it'll be like, what was that one? Total Recall in Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he gets in the Johnny cab and it's a plastic figurine that's in the front seat of the taxi. I mean, yeah, we're headed for, even if it's not due to deteriorating economic conditions, even if it's only technology, we're still headed for massive dislocations. So, and then I was in China recently, and you literally could not see in front of you. I mean, the air was almost that bad. So they're getting all the money, but they're getting all the pollution. I think at some point they will rebel just because it becomes unlivable there. You know, you could have all the money you want, but if you can't breathe the air, what good is it?
Right.
And each part of the world is going to have different reasons why they devolve into social unrest. So I think the issues that you raise here really, really important for you to consider if you haven't. I've said for a long time, if you're the only guy in the movie theater who knows where the exits are, it doesn't matter how much popcorn you bought at the concession stand.
Absolutely. Good. A very good analogy, Kerry. I would totally agree.
Yeah. So the concept of having a residence outside the country, but where do you go? I mean, you think that that there will be safe zones in the world that that are exempt from the unrest, the potential unrest? We don't know for sure this is going to happen. I mean, maybe adjustments will be made. You don't know, you know, the one thing we do know about the future is that the future is uncertain.
Well, one of the reasons I chose Panama was I think it's got a better chance than a lot of other countries to survive some real serious economic unrest, mainly because they have a stable source of government funding of $6 billion a year coming in through the canal. The one thing that's going to derail that would be a trade war, which we may be on the verge of.
Yeah.
I think global trade will continue. Even as people lose their jobs, there's always going to be people who in one country who want something made in another country. And if we don't erect tariff barriers, if we don't have a repetition of the 1930s where we had trade drop by 90% due to trade restrictions imposed by the United States and other countries, I think that Panama will do just fine. They will suffer the same sort of economic dislocations, albeit at a slower pace, just because they're just not as advanced as the United States. So the technologies that we're talking about that will be so destructive of employment in the United States will spread to other countries, but in less developed countries like Panama, they'll spread less quickly, I think.
Yeah, perhaps.
I hope.
Perhaps. They are in a dollarized economy, though. The U.S. dollar is their currency unit, so cause for concern. And they just did expand the Panama Canal. But these, right at the time where it looks like world trade had peaked, so we're going to have to see if trade comes back or not. War on cash. Wrote an article about this 2 years ago before anyone knew to call it the war on cash. I called it Operation Dirty Money because what I noticed was they weren't replacing the worn notes in circulation. They're just literally letting the money fall apart, which to me sent out a message. We don't want you to use cash, so we're making it physically undesirable for you to use cash. And it's all part of the program. So what's going to be with this war on cash? It's advanced in other parts of the world faster than in the U.S.
Well, this is a shocking prediction that I make, and I tell people this, and they're absolutely aghast when I say this. But I think cash as an asset class will essentially disappear in the next decade or two, except in small undeveloped economies. And all other economies, including the U.S., will be cashless. We'll have a chip in our shoulder, we'll have a chip in our hand, or maybe just a national card that we present. Eventually, it will be a chip. It's just very efficient to do it that way. Of course, the Revelation warns about this in the Bible. But I think the advantages that will be pointed out will be so profound. I mean, an end to identity theft, an end to a lot of crime. And the big thing, of course, is that we can go negative on interest rates if we don't have cash. You have all your money in the bank. If you don't spend it, 1%, 2%, 3% every year is siphoned off as a penalty for saving, because when the economy is weak, the government wants people who have money to spend. So if you're a saver, you're the enemy. And I think that's just going to intensify in the years ahead.
Yeah, well, it's interesting about cash because the banks hate cash because they got to pay money to store it. They got to pay money to ship it. They got these armored cars, which then on occasion get held up and people get shot. They really don't like cash. It's a real pain to them. Plus, the other thing is you can't leverage cash in the banking system. So cash is pulled out and it's got a deflationary effect on the system. So if you have $100,000 in the bank, and in theory, if you could turn it into cash, it'd probably take you 6 months the way the system's set up now, getting a few hundred here and a few thousand there. And then they tip off the government that you are behaving suspiciously. But if you could,
of course,
if you could pull it out, hypothetically, if you could pull it out, and get 100,000, that would be 100,000 less for them to leverage effectively. And there was an insurance company in Switzerland that tried to pull out their money from the bank because they didn't want to get hit with negative interest rates. And the Swiss government told them, no, you can't. So they can't hypothecate it. They can't fractional reserve it and lend it out 10 times or 100 times over. So the banks love the concept of a cashless society because whatever the percentage of cash in the system is, if that's gone, then they're free to loan it over and over and over again and earn money off of it.
Well, right. And the fact that we're moving in that direction shows you who's running, who's running the show.
Yeah.
It's the banks and the hand in hand with the policymakers and the academics and so on and government.
Yeah, that is for sure. So, hey, it's a real trend of people renouncing their U.S. citizenship. And so this is a trend. Obviously, these are wealthy people doing it for the most part. So they know something, don't they?
You know, we have expatriated the Nesma Group probably 70, 75 people in the last 15 years. Believe it or not, 90% of them were not wealthy. I mean, they were, in many cases, just ordinary middle-class people who were simply unable to function in the country they're living in because of the repressive policies of the IRS. So they're living overseas. They can no longer get bank accounts. They can no longer be employed because the employer fears that all the information that the employee has access to, or the employee, because he is a U.S. citizen, is going to force some sort of reporting issue on the employer and put the employer in a penalty situation. Now, these Americans living overseas cannot enroll in foreign retirement plans. And so this just becomes intolerable. They can't get insurance. After a while, they decide, you know what, I've had enough. I'm comfortable living in this country. I really don't want to expatriate. I don't want to give up my U.S. citizenship, but I feel that I have no alternative to do so because the U.S. operates this system of global taxation, where if you're a U.S. citizen, you have to pay tax on your worldwide income, no matter where you live. I mean, you could be living on the moon, and if you're a U.S. citizen, the United States would still want to impose tax on your earnings. Now, only 5,400 people expatriated in 2016. That does sound like a small number, but it's up by a factor of 10 since the early part of the 21st century. I think this is just the tip of the iceberg. The system only counts people who file a information form with the IRS. Yeah, many people don't bother. The numbers also don't jive with the reports I've read in the media. Reports such as a report I read out of Switzerland, where in 1 year, over 1,000 people expatriated in Switzerland alone. 2,000 people expatriate every year in Korea alone. So I think the numbers are probably closer to 50 or 60,000 a year rather than 5,409. But basically, no, they're not people. The people doing this are not particularly wealthy. I mean, some are. We had a very famous case of Tina Turner expatriating, and this fellow, Savrin, who was a co-founder of Facebook, he expatriated. Obviously, these folks are wealthy, but this is not typical. The vast majority, in our experience, of people who give up citizenship are ordinary people who simply can't exist in their adopted home overseas because of repressive U.S. tax policies. And by the way, the IRS, through executive action, simply by issuing regulations, could change this overnight. They choose not to. So Congress does not have to act. This could be done simply by the IRS commissioner Making a few policy changes to make life easier. They have chosen not to do it because they are convinced there is massive tax evasion occurring overseas. I think that's hogwash because most Americans who live overseas are living in high tax countries like Canada, the UK, France, and so on. The number of people living, Americans living in tax havens like Bermuda, Nevis, places like this, Panama, is infinitesimal compared to the ones living in the more developed high-tax countries like Canada and the UK.
Yeah, interesting. I remember Sir John Templeton. He was the first one I ever remembered renouncing his citizenship so he could become a citizen of the Bahamas, where they had a tiny, tiny tax. I don't even remember if they had an income tax at the time in the Bahamas. And he saved hundreds of millions of dollars in income taxes in the course of his life.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you do it, I mean, it is possible to save a lot of tax if you're very wealthy, if you expatriate. The problem is that they'll get you in the end. And if you have any U.S. beneficiaries in your estate, you know, they're going to be paying tax on their inheritance at a 40% rate. So they're going to get you sooner or later, even if you do give up your citizenship, if you're quite wealthy.
Understood. But this was before there was the exit tax and things
of that nature. Yeah. No, he expatriated years ago.
40 years ago.
I think lived 40 or 50 years in the Bahamas tax-free. So obviously he did save a lot of tax.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm sure other people got the idea. So just one other thing, precious metals, what's your take there? And Bitcoin we should throw in at this point is they're both kind of out there.
Well, I'm a big proponent of precious metals as an alternative currency, alternative asset class. I can't really give a number. I personally have about 25% of my net worth in precious metals. I can't give investment advice. I'm not a licensed investment advisor, but I'm very comfortable with having that much. I happen to buy at a fairly, at a good entry rate at around $400 an ounce for gold back in the early part of the 21st century. It's obviously much more expensive now. At these levels, I'm much more comfortable with the idea of dollar cost averaging. Let's say you want to put 25% of your net worth in precious metals. So you take that number, maybe you divide it by 60, and then every month you're buying 1/60th your position and dollar cost averaging the purchases, because we are in a scenario now with higher interest rates and a very strong dollar that precious metals prices are under pressure. If we have this border adjustment tax enacted that Trump wants, that's going to be a big boost to the dollar. If we have more interest rates hikes, I think that's going to be a big boost to the dollar. So I do like the idea of precious metals because this is not going to last forever. We are going to see a dollar shock at some point. But if you want to be careful about it, just buy a little bit every month. I think that's a great approach. And again, make sure it's fully allocated, gold or silver. Keep it at home in a safe place. A floor safe is best. Don't keep it in a safe deposit box in a bank. If you can afford to keep it overseas, even better.
Yeah, makes sense. Any opinion on Bitcoin?
You know, I like the idea of Bitcoin. I'm not sure it's going to be the final answer. There are a lot of Bitcoin has a lot of competition. I would love to see a fully gold-backed digital currency out there. Bitcoin is backed by an algorithm. I'm still trying to get my head around that. It seems to be pretty stable. It seems to be a good investment. Again, as an alternative asset class, I think these digital currencies are going to be huge in the years ahead. Bitcoin does add the promise of, if you do it right, at least anonymity. So I think there's a lot to say for it. I think it's a store of wealth. An anonymous store of wealth. It's fantastic. I mean, you could have, in theory, you could have a piece of paper with a barcode on it stored at home in your safe worth $1 million, however many bitcoins that represents. So I think it's a very intriguing concept. I would love to see a fully gold-backed digital currency out there, though, before I fully embrace the concept.
Yeah, well, they're working on it now. You've got things like BitGold and gold money. Interesting concepts. So people want to find out more about what you're doing, what you think they should be doing. Where's the best place to go?
Well, we're offering your listeners a free report that outlines many of our strategies that we discussed here today, Kerry. So if your listeners would go to Nessman.com, A-R-P-P, and I'll spell that out. My last name, Nessman, is N as in Nicholas, E-S, T as in Tom, M as in Michael, A, N is a Nicholas N, so two N's at the end, and then .com/ARPP, Apple, Rain, Peter, Paul.
All right. And if you got any questions or comments about this interview or any others we've done, just send me an email, kl@carrylutz.com. That's kl@carrylutz.com. You will find a link to Mark's site in the show notes to this interview, as always. Mark, it's really interesting listening to your advice, because it's so much of what I've been thinking about over the years, what I've shared with you out there over the years. And it's always better to have a plan and have to change the plan than to have no plan at all and have to think about what you're going to do and, you know, have to run for the exit at that point. Hey, love to have you back on again, Mark. Been a pleasure. And we will talk to you again soon.
Carrie, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.